are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, April 18th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Bill Barr takes questions on a report that we now just are seeing to the extent that we can see it. And guess what? It appears that Bill Barr somewhat misinformed the public as to some of the key findings of Robert Mueller. Also on the program, Sean McKelvey would join us from Data Progress, talking about the drama amongst the Democrats. Meanwhile, Democratic leaders call for Robert Mueller to testify. North Korea claims it has tested new tactical guided weapons. The Naval Academy is going to ban transgender students starting next year. Kentucky Congressman pulls a Dave Rubin and rescinds the invite to AOC to talk to minors. Australia ready to confirm the meeting which launched the Trump-Russia intel investigation. HUD implements a policy to harass folks living in poverty and pretends they are punishing the undocumented. Facebook teams with Tucker Carlson and the Daily Caller to launch a fact-checking service. And what's old is new again. The Trump administration announces new travel restrictions to people going to Cuba because it worked so well the first 50-some-odd years.
Going to crack them this time.
All this and more on today's program. Well, ladies and gentlemen, let me just give you a little bit of a timeline and a little bit of insight into how we do this show. So we didn't know what the timing was of the Mueller report in terms of when it was going to drop until this morning. And at 9:30 a.m., William Barr gave a press conference to ostensibly take questions on the report, with no one in the audience having seen any version of the report. Why would you do this? Well, we'll get into this, because this is really actually like a great lesson in how politics and spin works. The report was then released almost an hour ago to the minute. And so people are going through it. It's a 440-page report, I think it is. And apparently there's a real absence of the materials from the intel investigation. So this is strictly on the criminal aspects of it. And I'm going to read you, some excerpts, but I haven't read much of it at all. And so you can take with it what you want. Some of these excerpts come from, frankly, Twitter feeds of people on the left and on the right. These are really, you can't see them in context, but the paragraphs themselves make relevance. But Bill Barr's performance today was shocking, I guess, to a lot of people. I mean, you'll recall when he was nominated, I think we referred to him as, just as bad as Jeff Sessions, but smarter. And the guy has a long history of running interference for presidents, dating back to the Iran-Contra affair. There are a couple of pieces I've been reading about his role in misinterpreting a mispresenting Congress when he omitted parts of a Justice Department memo in 1989. That's when he was the head of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. It concluded at that time that the FBI could forcibly abduct people in other countries without the consent of a foreign state. And this was a way of paving the way of abducting Manuel Noriega during the first Bush administration. He also was part of the pardon process for people involved in Iran-Contragate. And so this guy has a long history of this. He also wrote a 19-page memo as a job application as to why the president can't obstruct. We will, again, go through some of these things in a moment. But the important thing to understand, I think, in this is that the point of the reason why they did this, the way that this has been done, it seems to me, is that, and it's quite clear that Mueller, at least on the question of obstruction, was, and he was not in a position to say this should go to Congress, but that I think he was anticipating this question should go to Congress. The reason why we're getting the report as opposed to not getting the report is I think the White House knew there's a certain inevitability to this report coming out, whether it was going to be subpoenaed by Congress, whether it was going to be leaked, regardless. And what they understand in the White House, and I imagine they understand this in Congress too, is that how the report is made public will, to a large extent, determine the way that it is absorbed by the public. So, for instance, the White House, here's a scenario. The White House does not release the report. And I say the White House because it's quite clear that that to talk about the independence of the Department of Justice at this point is sort of silly. So the White House decides not to release the report. When it comes out in the hands of Gerald Nadler, let's say. Maybe the Senate Judiciary Committee, and it's Patrick Leahy. And they get to be the ones, well, it wouldn't be Patrick Leahy. So it would be Gerald Nadler, right? Because the House would get it. And Leahy's not in charge of the committee in the Senate because it's controlled by Republicans. So Gerald Nadler would be out there, and he is going to be the one who's going to tell you the important parts. Like, you can go on to Donald Trump Jr.'s Twitter feed, and I'm sure he's pulling pictures of, you know, whatever it is, and you can get a sense of what the Mueller report says. And then you can go to Marcy Wheeler's Twitter feed, and you get a different sense of what the Mueller report is, right? And when you go to Twitter, you choose who's going to be your narrator. But in terms of the country, how the report gets to the public is what will determine who gets to be the narrator for that report. Bill Barr has been desperately trying to be the narrator for weeks now. I mean, to the point where he wanted to be he knew it was so important for him to be the narrator that he is taking questions on a report that none of the reporters have seen. So he knows they can't ask the questions that the reporters want to ask. They can only ask these general questions that he wants them to ask. I mean, if it was up to him, he'd want no press conference. He'd want no report. Obviously, he'd want none of this. But the report exists. So the question is, who gets to define to the public what that report means? And to some extent, that's like, you know, what this program does and what Rush Limbaugh does and what MSNBC does and what Fox does. I mean, to some extent, that's what the dissemination of news is all about. But in this case, in terms of the report, it is a much higher stakes game that they're playing. And so this is what's going down with this. And we're going to play a couple of clips from Bill Barr's thing. And I'm going to read a couple of things from the report. This is all incredibly preliminary. And frankly, at the end of the day, I don't know what it's going to mean for anything. I don't, you know, we still have a bunch of investigations that are extant. In terms of whether Donald Trump is going to be president between now and 2020, none of this means anything because he will be. And in terms of whether he is going to win his election in 2020, I don't know that any of this is implicated either. The speculation that somehow this would give Donald Trump a win and he would go around and this would be some type of benefit for him electorally is, I'm sorry, frankly silly. And there's absolutely no data to support that. If there was going to be a bump in the polls for Donald Trump, it would have happened before. Like, this would have been the period we would have seen it. Because now that the report is out there, and Bill Barr is not the only person who has seen it. I mean, just it's very, this is this is honestly like a children's book, right? Like, somebody goes, looks into the secret chest, comes out, and they're the one who tells you what's in it. Well, now the chest has been opened, and other people are getting to examine it. And to the extent that they can. And I can't tell. Obviously, I have not read through 440 pages. I don't know to what extent it is redacted and what parts are redacted. The percentage of the redactions, I imagine, are far less relevant than the redactions themselves. And so what we're going to do is we're going to play just so you get a sense of where we are today. Now, we're going on vacation today. And I was thinking about, like, how come every time we go on vacation, there tends to be these sort of big news things? And I don't think it's a coincidence. Now, I'm not suggesting that
they're afraid of our attention.
They're afraid of our attention. What I am suggesting is that this show goes on vacation as per the Department of Education in New York City's calendar. When I got to take care of the kids and they're on vacation, and the calendar generally follows when holidays are. So February vacation is during President's Day. Spring vacation is during Easter and Passover. Obviously Christmas vacation is during Christmas. And so I don't think it's a coincidence that Bill Barr presents this the day before Good Friday and going into the holidays. Just because, and I don't know that there's actual data to show this, but there's probably, like, if we got to drop it at some time, might as well do it during the time when we know people are going to holidays. And so it's not so much that they're scared of us. It's just like we're all on the same schedule. But, hey, folks, whether you're trying to get a sweet deal on something or find the best happy hour in town, it's generally a good idea to read the reviews first. So why should finding the right software for your business be any different? Read through thousands of real software reviews and find the right software for your business at Capterra.com/majority. Capterra is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. With over 750,000 6,000 reviews of products from real software users and more than 700 specific categories of software, from project management to email marketing, has everything you need to make an informed decision fast. If you have heard me talk about Capterra in the past, you know that I spend probably too much time just scrolling through the different categories, amazed at how many different professions are out there.
You have skill FOMO.
There is, honestly, that's exactly what it is. And the thing about Capterra, I mean, it's actually just, it's fun reading to just see the various types of businesses and software that exists for companies. You'd be shocked. I mean, just some of these categories. 360-degree feedback software, 3D architecture software, 3D CAD software. That's for, I think, like when you're making like product. What do you call those? Like
CAD is computer-aided drafting and design. Yeah.
All right.
You can make things.
Advocacy software. So that might be relevant to a lot of people who listen to this show. Or applicant tracking software. I'm still in the A's. Attendance tracking software. That might be good to find out how many times Michael misses the show here. Auto dealer accounting software. Let's go down to the, it takes you a half an hour to just get down to the G's. Garden center software. Garden gradebook software. Gymnastics software. Handyman software? Wait a second. Hold on for one second. Service Fusion, House Call Pro, Jobber, Vungo, Field Pulse. There's like 30 different softwares that you could use if you're a handyman business, and they all got reviews. It's pretty amazing. Visit Capterra.com/majority for free today to find the tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Capterra.com/majority. Capterra, that's Capterra.com/majority. Capterra software selection simplified. Also, you've heard me talk about the importance of getting term life insurance. You may not think you don't need a life insurance yet, but if you have loved ones who depend on you, you need to have a plan. There's a lot of reasons why you don't deal with insurance, because it's a hassle. But particularly if you have kids or a husband or a wife or a significant other in your life, life insurance can be really important. And thankfully, Ethos makes doing the responsible thing easy. With Ethos, you can get covered in 10 minutes online and even sign up right from your phone. No pesky paperwork. No pushy salespeople. Just choose a policy that fits your needs and don't waste time deciphering fine print. Ethos treats you like a person, not a risk. They work to make sure you have the right policy for your lifestyle and budget. They have a dedicated customer support team right here in the USA to help with any questions you may have. Visit ethoslife.com. Click Check My Price to get started on the quick online application. Insure your life today by going to ethoslife.com to apply online. Insuring your life and providing your family with financial security has never been easier. That's Ethos, E-T-H-O-S, life.com, and you are 10 minutes away from your estimated rate. Make sure your family's future is safe no matter what. Super easy to do. Check it out. Worth going through that very brief process to see how available life insurance can be to you. And lastly, the Majority Report is being supported in part by Simple Habit. Simple Habit, as you know, is a mobile app that provides a massive and diverse library of 5-minute guided meditations. The Majority Report audience can try Simple Habit totally for free for an entire week when you go to simplehabit.com/majority. Simple Habit has over 2,000 guided meditations specifically designed for parts of your day and just about anything you might be dealing with in life. They've guided meditations for mindfulness, anxiety, depression, when you're having trouble falling asleep, to deal with procrastination, to help you if you're a parent. They have meditations designed specifically for when you're waking up or your lunch break, when you've gotten home from work, when you're going to bed. Different people are trying to try different things with meditation. Simple Habit is able to cater to just about anyone, regardless of what their goals are with meditation, no matter how much past experience you have. The variety of guided meditations is what sets Simple Habit apart. And that's why they just won the 2018 Google Play Award for Best Wellbeing App. It's available iOS, Android, web browser. The Majority Report audience can try it for free by going to simplehabit.com/majority. If you're watching on YouTube or you're listening to the podcast in any manner, check the description. We got links down there. All right. Let's play this first clip from William Barr today in announcing the report. Rod Rosenstein looks like he has been shot with embalming fluid standing behind him. Let's play this.
In assessing the president's actions discussed in the report, it is important to bear in mind the context. President Trump faced an unprecedented situation. As he entered into office...
Just to be clear here. This is his response on obstruction. Now, the obstruction is going to be extremely controversial because when I read to you the part in the report when they talk about obstruction, it is quite clear that Robert Mueller anticipated the question of obstruction heading to Congress. But here is Barr talking about apparently intent. And I'm not quite sure how Barr divined intent, because we know that Mueller never had an opportunity to interview the president. And he, in the report, says the questions were not sufficient, that were written questions were not sufficient. But go.
In assessing the president's actions discussed in the report, it is important to bear in mind the context. President Trump faced an unprecedented situation. As he entered into office and sought to perform his responsibilities as president, federal agents and prosecutors were scrutinizing his conduct before and after taking office and the conduct of some of his associates. At the same time, there was relentless speculation in the news media about the president's personal culpability. Yet, as he said from the beginning, there was, in fact, no collusion. And as the special counsel's report acknowledges, there is substantial evidence to show that the president was frustrated and angered by his sincere belief that the investigation was undermining his presidency, propelled by his political opponents, and fueled by illegal leaks. Nonetheless, the White House fully cooperated with the special counsel's investigation, providing unfettered access to campaign and White House documents, directing senior
aides. I just want to be clear here. He's not reading from the report. He is just basically functioning as a political commentator. He is deciding that the White House fully complied. But Mueller does not say that. They did not sit down for an interview.
This sounds like it was written by Sarah Huckabee.
Honestly.
This is like the way in which Trump's language gets into everything, even like the most well-spoken amongst them.
Relentlessly speculated.
The no collusion. I'll read you what it says about collusion here. In evaluating whether evidence about collective action of multiple individuals constituted a crime, we applied the framework of conspiracy law, not the concept of collusion. In so doing, the office recognized that the word collude was used in communications with the acting attorney general confirming certain aspects of the investigation scope, and that the term has been frequently invoked in public reporting about the investigation. But collusion is not a specific offense or theory of liability found in the United States Code, nor is it a term of art in federal criminal law. There's no reason why the attorney general should be using this word. For those reasons, the office, this is the special counsel, focus in analyzing questions of joint criminal liability was on conspiracy as defined in federal law. Continue.
The White House fully cooperated with the special counsel's investigation, providing unfettered access to campaign and White House documents, directing senior aides to testify freely, and asserting no privilege claims. And at the same time, the president took no act that in fact deprived the special counsel of the documents and witnesses necessary to complete his investigation.
Pause it. The president maligned those people in public who were cooperating with the special counsel.
Rats.
Rats. Manafort's a brave guy for lying to the special counsel, pretending to be a cooperating witness. Wow.
Complete his investigation. Apart from whether the acts were obstructive, This evidence of non-corrupt motives weighs heavily against any allegation that the president had a corrupt intent to obstruct the investigation.
There is no official mechanism in which Bill Barr determined there were non-corrupt motives in this obstruction. There is not a single document. There is not a single written word. There is not a single report from an interview that would suggest that Bill Barr has any official way of knowing there were no non-corrupt motives about obstruction. That's just a lie. That's just a lie. That's just made up. Whole cloth. Let's talk about obstruction. The office learned that some of the individuals we interviewed or whose conduct we investigated, including some associated with the Trump campaign, deleted relevant communications or communicated during the relevant period using applications that feature encryption or do not provide for long-term retention of data or communications records. In such cases, the office was not able to corroborate witness statements through comparison to contemporaneous communications or fully question witnesses about statements that appeared inconsistent with other known facts. Accordingly, while this report embodies factual and legal determinations that the office believes to be accurate and complete to the greatest extent possible, given these identified gaps, the office cannot rule out the possibility that unavailable information would shed additional light on or cast in a new light the events described in the report. There's not enough information because people hid their tracks. Continue. All right, let's go to the next one where he talks about...
Did the special counsel indicate that he wanted you to make the decision or that it should be left for Congress? And also, how do you respond to criticism you're receiving from congressional Democrats that you're acting more as an attorney for the president rather than as the chief law enforcement officer?
Special Counsel Mueller did not indicate that his purpose was to leave the decision to Congress. I hope that was not his view, since we don't convene grand juries and conduct criminal investigations for that purpose. I didn't talk to him directly about the fact that we were making the decision, but I am told that his reaction to that was that it was my prerogative as Attorney General to make that decision.
That never came up? From the report, and do we have that thing where he says, like, this is not why you go to, you have, at one point, Barr says, this is not why we don't send this to Congress. This is not why we have grand juries and whatnot. But you have, the Mueller report saying, first, a traditional prosecution or declination decision entails a binary determination to initiate or decline a prosecution. But we determined not to make a traditional prosecutorial judgment. The Office of Legal Counsel found that the indictment or criminal prosecution of a sitting president in the capacity of the executive branch to perform its constitutionally assigned functions in violation of the constitutional separation of powers. In other words, okay. So the special counsel Mueller did not indicate his purpose was to leave. I hope this was not his view because we don't convene. He says this. I hope that was not his view because we don't convene grand juries and conduct criminal investigations for that purpose. However, in the report itself, it says, given the role of the special counsel as an attorney in the Department of Justice in the framework of the special counsel regulations, this office accepted the OLC's legal conclusion for the purpose of exercising prosecutorial jurisdiction. And apart from the OLC's constitutional view, we recognize that a federal criminal accusation against a sitting president would place burdens on the president's capacity to govern and potentially preempt constitutional processes for addressing presidential conduct. Okay. In other words, we did not bring an obstruction charge because we accept the OLC's view, the Office of Legal Counsel's view, that a criminal accusation against the sitting president would place burdens on the president's capacity to govern and potentially preempt constitutional processes for addressing presidential misconduct? What is the constitutional processes for addressing presidential misconduct? It is Congress investigating and deciding whether they're going to impeach. So, this is the part that's really going to nail Barr. That's really going to be highly problematic, because the report absolutely says, doesn't say the words, because we're giving this to Congress. It says, we're not going to bring a criminal charge because it could potentially preempt constitutional processes for addressing presidential misconduct. I mean, I don't know what else to tell you. That's going to be rather damning. All right, let's take a quick break. We're going to get back to Sean McKelvey. We'll get back to more of this in a bit. Quick break first, and we'll be talking to Sean McKelvey. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Sean McKelvey. He is the co-founder and chief meme officer. Is it chief meme development officer or just chief meme officer for Data for Progress? Welcome back to the program, Sean.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Is it chief meme developer officer or just chief meme officer?
Normally just chief meme officer. I try to ensure quality assurance for all of the memes that appear on the Data for Progress Twitter page.
All right. I'm glad to hear that. All right. So a question for you. This week, I mean, obviously, the Mueller report is going to be sucking up a lot of oxygen going forward. But the past couple of weeks have been dominated by a couple of narratives, or I'd say probably three. One starts with Ilhan Omar, and that in many respects sort of ended up being laid over the dynamic of Nancy Pelosi and who she called the five, you know, just five, I guess, progressives or five incoming women from the freshman class of the Democratic House. Diminishing the relevance of folks like AOC and Tlaib and Ilhan Omar and I guess maybe Porter and others, and also more recognition that the leadership of the House, Pelosi, is not interested in Medicare for All, despite the fact that that seems to be sort of like and you can speak to this, I think, from a data perspective as to where that position is amongst both elected and Democratic voters. And then also sort of capping with, and no pun intended, the Bernie Sanders Think Progress / CAP, Center for American Progress, dust up. Well, give me your broad take before we get a little bit more granular with this stuff.
You know, someone told me yesterday they thought Data for Progress was an arm of Center for American Progress. I thought that was funny because Neera Tanden yelled at me a lot on Twitter because I said that Joe Biden was going to turn off young voters and people of color. But I'd say my my sort of overarching take on this is this with the DCCC blacklist?
And yes,
that as well?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. That's another part of this. Yeah. The DCCC blacklist, of course, was the DCCC, this is the Congressional Reelection Committee, said that if you are a vendor and you're going to work with a primary challenger, you will never get work in a general election from us.
Yeah. It will be funny to see if, like, AIPAC ends up using, like, all Republican vendors when they try to take out Ilhan Omar. But I'd say that there's a sort of view within the party that primaries are, like, toxic and the people who run in primaries are malignant. And I think it's far from that. I mean, I think that you have a lot of members of the Democratic caucus who, as far as, you know, Pelosi and Bustos are concerned, are members in good standing who are, in fact, you know, far from the values of the party. It's odd to me, for example, that, you know, Omar has taken all this heat when, you know, just 2 weeks ago, the Democratic Party passed an LGBTQ rights legislation, you know, that sort of enshrines civil rights for LGBTQ folks. And Dan Lipinski, who's a Democrat from Illinois, did not sign on to that resolution. That seems to me to be, like, far more offensive than anything Ilhan Omar has ever done, pretty objectively. And yet the official position of the Democratic Party is if you work, you know, on a primary against that bigoted member, you know, you're a pariah and you'll never get any contracts from the DCCC. And in fact, they'll tell red to blue Democrats that they shouldn't work with you. So I think there's, like, sort of a ton of inconsistency on this. I mean, there were multiple members of Congress who returned donations from Ilhan Omar. And, you know, at the same time, there are at least two members from New York, Kathleen Rice and Tom Suozzi, who have taken money from Trump and have refused to return the money from Trump. So I think there is absolutely a double standard. And the fact that Democratic leadership and red to blue Democrats are piling on Ilhan Omar for, you know, very, very tepid comments at a time when the president is literally working to incite violence against her is just despicable. And I mean, you know, it's not what we were promised. Remember, if you remember, the promise that Pelosi, Hoyer, Nadler, all of them made was, you know, we're going to take Congress, we're going to investigate the Trump administration. Day after day, we're just going to be subpoenaing Trump officials. And I haven't seen any of that. What I've seen is a Democratic leadership that's more interested in investigating and prosecuting the progressive women of color in their caucus than they are in doing anything about Trump. I forgot if I was allowed to say swear words on this show or not.
You can, but sparsely, because we do have kids
okay.
listening.
All right.
And
That's a good point, though. I'm very upset about that.
All right. Well, so let me ask you this. How much of the Ilhan Omar thing is about, you know, being on the right side as far as they're concerned of a question of Israel, which is basically you can't critique Israel or our policies regarding Israel? And how much of it is this is like a twofer? You know, we also get to undercut this movement that we feel is threatening to us.
Yeah, I mean, it's really baffling because, you know, as someone who supports primary challengers, was very supportive of AOC, you know, and Ayanna Pressley, the whole time we were doing that, everyone was like, do not focus on primary Democrats. We need to take on Trump. And yet, you know, like those same Democrats are now, instead of focusing on Trump, focusing on, you know, this is an attempt to humiliate and ostracize, you know, one of the most progressive women of color in the caucus and also one of the very few Muslim members of Congress. It's genuinely despicable for, you know, her own party to be, I think, trying to make an example of her. I think the Democratic Party is saying, you know, if you're a Muslim, you know, you probably shouldn't run for Congress, but if you do, like, we're going to make it hell for you. But yeah, I absolutely think that there is a sense among the caucus that, you know, these progressives who speak so much to and for the base, they need to be put in line. They need to be silenced because there's this view that they're somehow hurting reelection chances, despite the fact that, you know, AOC and Anna Presley were very popular national figures before the election, and there was no impact on the midterms. I distinctly remember everyone telling me, you know, oh, abolish ICE is going to cost us seats. And I said, I think we're going to take the House, and I'd love for someone to identify afterwards which seat we lost because of abolish ICE. And if you can identify the seat, I'll pay you $100 per. And no one has. No one has come to me and they're like, Sean, we've done the regression models. We would have picked up this seat if it wasn't for abolish ICE. And the reason is because, like, everyone knows that's not true. And I think members are free to say, you know, like, hey, you know, AOC's one vision for the Democratic Party. I'm you know, somewhat more conservative. But that's not the path they've taken. They said not only is, you know, Ilhan Omar not my vision for the Democratic Party, she's actively toxic on par with Steve King. When I saw Dan McCready, like, returning donations from Ilhan Omar, I was like, wow, like, this is more aggressive than the way the Republican Party treated Steve King. Like, they are treating her as though she's, like, a white supremacist in terms of the way they're interacting with her. And it is just disgusting.
You know, I don't think it's a coincidence, but I do seem to remember, like, the first attempt. It sort of felt like it was, like, a almost a dry run was when Tlaib was being ostracized for saying, let's impeach the mofo. And that was, it seemed to be short-lived because people were like, yeah, wait a second, let's impeach the mofo. And the
that
idea,
was their entire message. And the going into the midterm.
Well, I mean, I think that's an exaggeration, but I think there was certainly a subtext of, we're going to investigate the hell out of the guy.
Right.
And that may lead to impeachment. But people were trying to sort of say, like, it's inappropriate to say impeach because you're saying that you're going into this process, you know, with a predetermination. And then they were like, oh, that's not going to work. Well, it's not appropriate to say mofo. And then people remembered, wait a second, didn't Dick Cheney say this stuff on the floor of the Senate to people? Was it, you know, like, I mean, aren't we past that now? The president of the United States said you can grab him by the vagina. He didn't use that word. I don't know why I won't say pussy, but so, I mean, there does seem to be, like, there was a real attempt to find something. And I think if, you know, we've gone through Ilhan Omar's comments ad nauseum at this point, and they were completely mischaracterized, and they were a very specific complaint about a real thing that was happening both on the state level and in the Senate at the time in terms of a pledge to not protest against Israel that people were being forced to sign.
I'll say two things on this. I mean, one is notable. Do you remember it was sort of like a smaller story, but recently, Elijah Cummings, who, remember, was like, we were all supposed to stand a king because he was going to, like, come in there and just, like, roast every member of the Trump administration. And instead, the most recent reporting is that he's been actively seeking bipartisan support for any subpoenas that he initiates, and that he has said privately he's not going to go after any of Donald Trump's children because he fears that it'll, like, look bad and it'll turn the public against them. So, like, this is a Democratic Party that is more comfortable, you know, dragging and degrading a woman of color in their own caucus than they are the president's corrupt, racist children. And that's just, it's quite frankly disgusting. And I think that it really goes back to, like, they like the way it was done in the past. And there's a very real sense, and it's uncomfortable to say, but it's a very real sense in which, like, Elijah Cummings is more comfortable with the Republicans who he has worked with for two decades than he is with this new freshman class of young progressive Democrats. And I think that that's the reason that it's all the more important to put progressive pressure on these members, because if they don't feel the base, you know, like on their nipping on their heels every day, they're going to go back to the instinctive sort of like bipartisan DC Beltway style of politics.
Right. Of course. And let me get let me ask you this. And I know you deal with a lot of different activist groups and a lot of different groups that are trying to get Democrats elected, a lot of groups that are trying to push Democrats to the left. What is your sense? Is what is behind that? I mean, because, you know, I talked to David Dayan yesterday about Wendell Primus, who is Nancy Pelosi's one of her top advisors, and very sort of like interesting story of a guy who was so principled in 96 that he quit the Clinton administration over welfare reform. You know, as also seems to be adamantly against Medicare for all in a, you know, a fairly, I have not heard like a reasoned rationale behind that as much as like, this is the way, you know, this is, we can't change the weather type of rationale to it. Like, what is your sense of what drives that? Is it really just like personal comfort? Is it just a, is it a temerity? Is it a fear? Are we talking about something that's generational? What is your sense of that?
Yeah, I think the first aspect is that there is absolutely a generational aspect to this. Like, it's notable that even the sort of more centrist red to blue representatives are pretty supportive of Medicare, Medicare for all, or at least a buy-in, but often more. I mean, Haley Stevens, for example, red to blue Democrat in Michigan, who is a member of the Medicare for All caucus. You know, Katie Hill represents a district that was a Republican district that is now a Democratic district, you know, also quite progressive and supports Medicare for All. So I think you have this very, very distinct generational divide. But I think the biggest and most important thing is that every one of these members of Congress, you know, they're not getting their public opinion briefings from Data for Progress. You know, we're not getting in those rooms and being like, hey, like Medicare for All is quite popular. Republicans have tried running, you know, ads about it. It hasn't been effective. You know, you guys, there were tons of members of Congress who were sitting members of Congress who the entire Republican message against them was they support Medicare for All and it's going to destroy Medicare as we know it. And it didn't work. They won. But, you know, the consultants that get in the room to present them with polling are all presenting with the polling like, oh, you know, you should support a buy-in. You support something more modest. We need to talk about protecting the Affordable Care Act. That's the message that works. And I think that the pollsters sort of have this mystification around them that allows for them to have more influence and power. But I would put, you know, I would go pound to pound with any of the pollsters that are in those rooms in terms of my ability to do basic statistics, weighting, etc., etc.
All right, wait a second. So I want you to just back up a little bit and just understand sure. That you're talking to people who don't do this for a living. So just when you talk about, you know, like pollsters going in, just give us a 101 course on how Congress people look at their reelection, or they evaluate the election that they just went through, or, you know, give us a sense of what the process is so that we can understand, like, you know, what relevance it is who is actually who are the players? Do you understand what I'm asking?
You want to know the specific, like, names of the pollsters?
No, not necessarily the specifics of the name of the pollster, but the dynamic, like the day-to-day. If you were describing how this, you know, if I'm a congressperson and I've just gone, it was a Republican district and I had, you know, I was a neophyte and I won somehow. Who do I, you know, who am I talking to over the next couple of months or the past couple of months? And how do I get to those people? And what are they telling me?
Sure. I mean, so the DCCC has their an approved list of vendors for polling. And, you know, for the most part, members rely on those vendors. There are probably four or five. And I'll be clear, like, they're not there because, like, they're math geniuses who are developing new methods. You know, most of them are using basically the same polling methodologies we've been using for years. slowly moving to sort of more online panels, maybe some SMS.
What is that?
Oh, text messages.
Okay. All right, sure.
Recruiting people through text messages. Yeah. So they're not being there because of their, like, methodological genius. The reason they're there is because they are sort of, you know, modern oracles. Almost all of them have been, like, sort of senior advisors on various campaigns, you know, be it Obama or even earlier than that, you know, in a lot of cases. You know, many of these guys are still around from, like, the Bill Clinton era. And the reason you ever would hire a pollster, and, like, you know, you can ask around on this, like, it's like, well, you know, half of it's the polling, but the real thing is like, you want to have one of these guys who has a name that people respect and who, you know, when they send an email, you reply to their email. When they're in the room, you listen to what they say. And so those folks control, you know, most of the sort of polling budget of organizations like the DCCC. And they will circulate quite often, you know, slide decks, memos internally showing the various support and opposition for different policies. And, you know, you'll have a lot of instances in which the DCCC or the House Majority PAC will sort of get the members together to hear polling presentations, research presentations. Sometimes they'll commission their own polling for the district. And, you know, to the extent that is useful, a lot of it has to do with the structure of the polling question, and also has to do with, you know, how what questions do you include on your polls? Because you can't really measure something that you're not actually polling on. And there's a famous social scientist named Andrew Gelman, and he talks in sort of in the social science world about what's called the garden of forking paths. And the basic idea is that whenever you're doing a survey instrument, whenever you're doing a research project, there are lots of different degrees of freedom that you have that allow you to sort of manipulate the result in a way that, you know, seems perfectly reasonable. If you sort of, every time you come to a crossroads in sort of methodological design, you go in one direction or the other. You know, the choice to, if you were, say, ask a question to include support, oppose, and a don't know, you know, that's going to change the options. If you don't include a don't know, you're forcing people to make a decision. If you do include a don't know, you know, you might have more people go in that bucket. And so the point being that these sorts of researcher degrees of freedom are incredibly large in the polling world. So it allows for, you know, the sort of hidden biases of the pollster, of the researcher, to come through. My argument is that the best solution for that is to have a broad, diverse range of people. But obviously the DCCC, the Democratic Party, have a pretty definitive set of folks who have their views on the world pretty well shaped, you know, by the politics of the 90s and early aughts.
Right. That seems to be the sort of the determinant factor here is when your politics are shaped and you learn the lessons of that era, and it encumbers your ability to imagine anything different. And it seems that for years the difficulty has been in getting folks like you in the room to at least provide some type of counter narrative. And that process, and it's interesting because we had a sort of a moment of being able to bypass that to a little bit, right? Where folks like you had access to another generation of politicians because of their outsider status and because of where they were situated ideologically, they proved to be fairly successful, right? I mean, give me assess. I mean, how would we assess that? Like, you know, and what would be the benchmarks? Like, Justice Dems, they didn't do. How well did they do? Let's say, and how would you measure that? Just to get a sense of this, A and B.
Sure.
To the extent that they did well or not, how much does that influence the conversation?
I mean, I would say, first off, it's actually very hard to win a House primary against an incumbent. It happens very rarely, which is why it's so notable when it happened. And to the extent that the Justice Democrats sort of like, you look at all the number of endorsements they made, how many won, it's not a wildly impressive record. But if you look at the sort of most important endorsement they made and what she has done to change the discourse in the country, I think the rest of the record is very impressive. You know,
right.
The sort of primary model has fundamentally changed the sort of shape of American politics. Like, the idea of a Green New Deal is something that will almost certainly be discussed in the debates, you know, this year. And that is solely because, you know, this member of Congress, Ocasio-Cortez, has become, you know, the third or fourth most famous woman in the Democratic Party. She has an incredible amount of influence over the next generation of Democrats. So I think that this model has been an incredibly effective one of sort of, you know, cultivating the next generation of talent. And I think that we will see more of that this cycle. You know, I think that we're going to see, we already saw like the FEC Q1 reports are back. So Marie Newman, who is back for a rematch against Dan Lipinski, she raised more than Dan Lipinski did. And there was a guy named Stephen Lynch. He's a Massachusetts rep. He's one of the most right-wing Democrats in the country. He briefly had a challenger named Mohammed Dar. Dar had to drop out because of family medical issues. But Dar raised $180,000 in the very few weeks that he was running. That's more than Lynch raised in the entire quarter. So I think that you're seeing an incredible amount of energy already behind the progressive primaries. The fact that we've already had two members be outraised in the first quarter of, you know, 2019 is quite frankly astounding, because some of the biggest raisers haven't even hopped in. So I think that there's absolutely a next generation of talent, like, nipping at the heels of incumbent Democrats. The fact that the DCCC is trying to so aggressively move against us is, I think, very strong evidence of this. And I think that Ocasio-Cortez and Ayanna Pressley and Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar need backup. And I think that if we have a caucus that grows to a dozen members, you know, that caucus will have real weight. And if that caucus can, like, you know, credibly say, look, like, you know, we can beat you in a primary, like, you're out of touch with where the next generation of the Democratic Party is, that I think is going to fundamentally change the sort of calculus that, you know, someone like Nancy Pelosi is operating under.
In many respects, the pushback we're seeing is a function of a fear that the plan you just espoused could actually happen, right? Like, they don't want...
Oh, I think it's absolutely, yeah.
They don't want a half a dozen or even three or four sitting congresspeople to be primaried, beaten, and replaced by people who are more progressive, because not because of those three or four votes per se, but because that becomes a cudgel that is used against a lot of those people in the House, and it's leverage. I mean, it's just leverage, right?
Yeah, and I think that the left has been very effective strategically in sort of rejecting the a sort of style of politics that doesn't include as central racial justice and gender equality. You know, the fact is like, we are in a much better position now with AOC and Ilhan Omar than we would be if, you know, both of them were white guys. Because, you know, that our base wants to see that representation in Congress. I'd say that's the first key point. But I actually wrote a piece of The Nation, which I sort of discussed what I call the normie progressive left alliance, which is basically, you know, a standard issue, hyper energized Democrats who are incredibly frustrated by the fact that, say, Richie Neal is dragging his feet on Trump's taxes, are, I think, hyper-primed to vote for primary challengers. Plus, you have the left that's making a more ideological critique. If you have those sorts of groups come together against an incumbent, I think that incumbent is in a lot of hot water. And the fact that the sort of the leadership, the caucus, is continuing to drag their feet on Trump, continuing to attack members who are in good standing with the base, I think makes all the more likely that there are a lot of Democrats who voted in 2018 expecting to see rigorous oversight of the Trump administration that are ready to throw the bums out, who will also align with the left, because almost certainly whoever is going to run in these primaries is going to be running from the more progressive standpoint.
So let me ask you this lastly, I guess. Do you think that there has been one of the stories that was sort of floating around was that there has been sort of a demobilization of, I guess, what you could call, broadly speaking, the resistance? I'm not quite sure I know what that means anymore, right? Like, because it seems like the leadership of the Democratic Party is being less resisting than the Democratic average Democratic voter wants them to be, which I think is, maybe that's not uncommon, but it's surprising, right? I mean, for all the talk of how people have been leveraging the Mueller investigation, the Democratic Party now seems to be sort of like lagging in terms of the actual electeds. But this argument that there's been demobilization, that we don't have, you know, people protesting. I mean, maybe it's because I don't know what they would be protesting at this point. I think there's a broad understanding that, you know, not that there's sort of a stalemate to a certain extent, except for probably on judges. So what is your sense about that question? I mean, are the prospects for Democrats going into 2020 sort of like generically speaking any better or worse than they were going into 2018? I mean, or is the intensity less, or is it hard to know?
I would say that there's definitely reason to believe the intensity has decreased. I mean, you remember what it was like after 2018? Like, do you remember like the attention that was given to like John Ossoff's special election in Georgia that had quite literally like zero impact on any meaningful like political outcome in the House?
Right.
And you compare that to, you know, we just lost a Wisconsin Supreme Court seat like 2 weeks ago. We literally, the Democratic Party lost for a decade the chance to draw fair maps in Wisconsin, and like no one cared. Like no one in the presidential field was like going out there to campaign. You know, we just got beat back, and like I still think about that every day. But I think for the most part, the cycle has moved on. And sort of any anger about that has diminished. And I think that is, to me, very powerful evidence that there has been at least some, you know, tapering of enthusiasm. And I think a lot of that is in part being driven by, you know, I would say it's an intentional demobilization of many parts of the Democratic base that House leadership is involved in, because I think a mobilized base is a threat to them, and they see the conservative, the Republican Party does not see a conservative mobilized base as a threat to them, but they're in a lot of ways, I think the Democratic Party does see a mobilized progressive base as a threat to them, and that's worrying, and it's also sad. But I also think that I mean, I have talked to a lot of people in the primary movement, and in the next few months, I think we're going to see some very exciting candidates who come onto the playing field who I think will have a lot of opportunity to sort of give us a hope for a new generation of progressive, a new generation of Democrats.
Sean McElwee, co-founder and chief meme officer for Data for Progress. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Always glad to be on.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half. There's obviously more and more stuff is coming out about the Mueller report, ranging from, you know, where I guess like uh, different people are reading different things into it, but President, here's one, just one that I'm reading now. The president's efforts to influence the investigation were mostly unsuccessful, but that is largely because the persons who surrounded the president declined to carry out orders or accede to his requests. In other words, like Comey did not end the investigation to Flynn, which ultimately resulted in Flynn's prosecution and conviction to lying in the FBI. Don McGahn did not tell the acting attorney general that the special counsel must be removed, but insisted, but instead prepared to resign over the president's order. Lewandowski and Dearborn did not deliver the president's message to Sessions that he should confine the Russia investigation to future election meddling only. McGahn refused to recede from his recollections about events surrounding the president's direction to have the special counsel removed. That, to me, sounds like he refused to accede to the president's request that he lie. Despite the president's multiple demands, he did so. Consistent with that pattern, the evidence we obtained would not support potential obstruction charges against the president's aides and associates beyond those already filed. In other words, the president tried to get these people to perjure themselves or do illegal things to obstruct the investigation, but they said no. I mean, that's like I attempted to fire a gun at you, but it jammed. Well, I think you can still be charged with attempted murder. I tried to stab you, but I only got you in the arm. So I didn't kill you. But your mileage may vary, folks. There's also apparently some tidbits about people lying from the podium spokespeople. This is President's draft termination letter also stated that the morale of the FBI was at an all-time low, and Sarah Sanders told the press after Comey's termination that the White House had heard from countless FBI agents who had lost confidence in Comey, but the evidence does not support those claims. They're just lying. They were just lying.
And where it should have stopped is at the deal standpoint, where they thought about it.
There you go. So obviously more of this will come out over the coming days. I'm going to try and get on, do maybe a special little broadcast and maybe do a YouTube live type of thing. In which case, maybe I'll try and pop that on the website. But we're going to talk more about this in the fun half. We'll take your phone calls. If you are a listener of the free show, this will be the last live thing we do for over a week. We've got six great interviews for you over the next 6 days, six business days, as it were, ranging from New York Times Magazine a piece on the Murdochs to in-depth discussion about misogyny in our society, the logic of it, to talking about philanthropic foundations and how they function, to what else did we have? I can't even remember now. What was the, what is it? What are we doing on Monday?
Monday, we have.
You don't know.
I don't have it in front of me right
there
now.
There you go. I like how you just like saddled up to the microphone and thought that you could.
Someone
just,
had to say
you
something.
You could just pull it off. In the meantime, take a leap into the future with Capterra.com, the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. With over 750,000 reviews of products from real software users, Capterra can help you make an informed decision no matter what your business needs. Visit Capterra.com/majority for free today to find the right tools to make the 2019 the year for your business. Capterra.com/majority. Capterra, that's Capterra.com/majority. Folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. When you go to join the Majority Report and actually join the Majority Report, for pennies a day, we bring you extra content. You can go back and check the archives. When you get on the app and you log in, you can search 8 years worth of archives and keyword searches and whatnot, find all sorts of great interviews. Fun thing to do maybe in the next coming week. But again, we'll try and do some live updates. If things work out, according to my plan, on vacation, the kids will be occupied for at least part of the day. So maybe I'll try and hop on the computer and give some updates, maybe even some conversations if I can swing it. So check that out. Join the majoritireport.com. It is your support that makes the show possible. This is absolutely the case. And I get a little sentimental before I go on vacation. So thank you to our members. In the meantime, check out the Michael Brooks Show. No live show Tuesday, but things have been posted on the Patreon and as well as on Jamie's The Antifada, patreon.com/TheAntifada, and Literary Hangover, though.
Yeah, there's going to be some George Orwell looking back on the Spanish War this Saturday, and then during the week probably, or maybe the Saturday after that, some Patreon-only content on a different George Orwell essay on the Spanish Civil War where he's upset that he was a Trotskyist called a fascist. It's kind of like an Antifada.
There's a lot of like...
Orwell has a little bit of overlap with those sorts of debates.
All right, folks, going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. 646-257-3920.
Calling from a 919 area code. Who's this? Where you come from?
Wow.
Awesome, awesome, awesome.
Well, let's just do this exercise.
Okay, you know what?
Whoa, whoa. Super sick.
It's all good.
Super sick.
Hell yeah.
Right. You don't need the means test, Social Security. You don't need the means test.
Medicare.
Nobody cares.
The way that you
means test
to tax wealthy people more.
What's the point?
And that's just simply not enough.
And as you always say, as soon as you stick in that access, less than we already do of universal health.
I have access to BMW.
Right.
This is a weird, weird, weird time for politics right now.
That's legit.
Galaxy brain. This is a freak show.
Love it all.
He finally gets to fulfill his destiny. Workers, the Molly, yeah, that's the little baby.
Very legal.
Very cool.
I thought this was a joke.
Hamburg alert.
Well, I mean, but things are really bad. But.